The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Pat Perry for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Money Matters. Today's episode of Money Matters is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the News and Observer. Today's stories include: Despite aid, thousands in North Carolina have filed for bankruptcy. And two U.S. economists win Nobel Prize for working on improved auctions. And we'll begin with: Despite aid, thousands in North Carolina have filed for bankruptcy. Daron Solomon, a deputy sheriff in Halifax County, filed for bankruptcy after the hours at his second job tending rental properties were cut when the pandemic hit. Robin Hullett and her husband Kevin, a factory worker from Burnsville, filed because steep medical bills kept coming. Elizabeth McIntosh and her husband John filed because his health couldn't take truck driving anymore, and less money in a safer job couldn't cover the bills from his heart attack years before. Solomon, Hullett, and McIntosh are among the more than 3,000 people in North Carolina who filed for bankruptcy from April through September. The number is less than before the pandemic, but experts worry it is a brief reprieve from a deluge expected once some federal relief efforts subside. Since the coronavirus swept through the state in March, federal and local officials have pulled out every stop to prevent economic bleeding. Evictions were postponed. Water wasn't shut off for unpaid bills. Most foreclosures were delayed. Still, thousands sought bankruptcy protection. Filings fell about 30% during the pandemic, but a steady stream of bankruptcies kept coming as COVID-19 raged. Extra unemployment benefits, $1,200 checks, sent to most Americans, the Paycheck Protection Program, they helped, but the efforts didn't move the needle on the deeper issues. A decline in filings, though, suggests those measures ease some of the pressure. When these assist end, experts worry about a wave of filings. The underlying issues that drive bankruptcies, they say, have gotten worse in the pandemic. Why are people still filing? People still have debt, said Robert Lawless, a law professor at the University of Illinois and an expert on consumer bankruptcy. Healthcare is still unaffordable for most. Low-wage work still can't cover the expenses of conventional American life, such as a car payment and school supplies. Being poor, experts say, is expensive. The cycles of debt that trap people haven't relented during the pandemic. In fact, with millions more Americans out of work, bankruptcy lawyers agree that the struggles have worsened. When foreclosures, evictions, and other debt collections start again, and some already have, thousands of North Carolinians and hundreds of thousands of Americans will be thrust back into an economic sweatbox. It doesn't matter what the relief packages are now, said Duke University law professor Sarah Green. It could be for some people that they really were on the edge of filing. Then COVID-19 comes along and it makes things worse. They were just ecking by. COVID-19 came along and it was just the nail in the coffin. The pain from these bankruptcies is not equally shared. The Charlotte Observer and the North Carolina News Collaborative compiled a database of the 1,760 bankruptcies filed in North Carolina between May 1st and July 30th. While bankruptcy filings don't typically include data on race, the filings were cross-referenced with a person's voter registration, which often includes race. Of the filings examined, 90% of voter registrations included race. An analysis suggests that in North Carolina, black residents filed bankruptcy at a rate 50% greater than white residents, a sign of how financial distress can affect communities of color with more severity. White people filed for bankruptcy at a rate of 13.28 per 100,000 white residents. Black people filed at a rate of 21.56 per 100,000 black residents. The reason black people filed at a higher rate isn't immediately clear, although they are overrepresented in filings historically. It could hold clues about where the economy is headed, experts said. This may be the canary in the mine shaft, said Bruce Markle, a law professor at Northwestern University and a former federal bankruptcy judge. While he cautioned that an analysis has yet to be done on the drivers of bankruptcies filed this year, we know that the pandemic hits African Americans harder, and we know that they lost jobs sooner. The most vulnerable people get hurt the most, and they turn to bankruptcy because that's the only relief they get. Other than race, location also skewed filings. Two coastal counties, Tyrrell and Washington, had the highest rate of people declaring bankruptcy. These were more than four bankruptcies for every 10,000 residents in those counties. North Carolina averaged about 1.7 bankruptcies filed for every 10,000 residents. Mecklenburg County residents filed the most bankruptcies at 154, followed by Wake County at 131 and Guilford County at 108. The figures roughly match up to the population centers of North Carolina. The average age of those who filed was 53. A bankruptcy filing can be divided into two categories, the cause and the catalyst. People typically don't file for bankruptcy because they just lost their job. They file because they lost their job and their medical bills keep piling up and their car payment is still due and so is their mortgage. The layered mountain of debt is the cause of the bankruptcy. But a smaller event such as a pink slip or an emergency room visit can be the catalyst that pushes someone to file. People usually hang on for a while and try to negotiate with the creditors, said Karen Moskowitz, director of the Consumer Protection Program at the Charlotte Center for Legal Advocacy. And then something will send them over the edge. For Solomon, the deputy sheriff, his catalyst was lost income. His hours were cut at a second job because of the pandemic. He filed for bankruptcy July 7th, listing $52,000 in debt. The ultimate cause of Solomon's bankruptcy was the mortgage on his house in Roanoke Rapids. He had missed some payments, and he said he couldn't work out a forbearance plan with his lender, 21st Mortgage. Solomon needed about $5,000 to catch up on payments. He worked another part-time gig at a funeral home, helping run services, but fewer hours with a different job tending rental properties meant he couldn't come up with the cash fast enough. Because of the bankruptcy protection, Solomon got to keep his house. The most important thing was to keep my home, he said. Anything else other than that can be recovered, you know. Bankruptcy can carry a daunting social stigma, but it is a useful economic tool. If done in a certain manner, the process allows people to wash away thousands of dollars in debt, stay in their homes, and restart their lives. Though many filed for bankruptcy during the pandemic, the government's intervention did help some. That stimulus helped us a whole bunch, a tremendous amount, said Robin Hewlett, referring to the $1,200 check that the federal government sent out to most Americans. She used it to buy some groceries and pay down some bills. But bankruptcy was an outcome that a $1,200 check couldn't stave off. Their debts were unrelenting, Hallett said. Legal experts call this the sweatbox. It's the period before bankruptcy where the debts become insurmountable. Bankruptcies loom large and life becomes a fraught mess of calculations. Roughly half of all people in this pre-bankruptcy period forego some medical care, according to data from the Consumer Bankruptcy Project, a research project into the consumer bankruptcy in the U.S. A quarter go without food sometimes. The sweatbox meant the Hallets were eating ramen noodles and cardboard pizza most of the time, according to Robin Hallett. For Robin and her husband, Kevin, the factory worker, their thousands in medical debts put them in the sweatbox. An arm injury has kept Robin from working, but she says she doesn't qualify for disability. Creditors have hounded them to collect on their debts, some of which were as small as $170. They wanted to protect their single-wide mobile home on a quarter acre in Burnsville. May 19th, they filed for bankruptcy. While the medical bankruptcies fuel the passage of the Affordable Care Act a decade ago, the reality on the ground hasn't changed much. Medical debt is still a top driver of consumer bankruptcies in the U.S. A 2019 study found that about two-thirds of all bankruptcies had the cost of medical care as a factor. Like the Hallets, Elizabeth McIntosh and her husband, John, turned to bankruptcy because of medical bills. John was a truck driver until a blockage in his arteries put him at risk of having a second heart attack, Elizabeth said. For one of his procedures, he was flown to Johnson City, Tennessee, on a helicopter that was not in network for his health insurance. That left an almost $23,000 bill to be paid by the McIntoshes. John had to give up driving trucks for a job that paid half as much. Still, the helicopter bill needed to be paid. On May 22nd, they filed for bankruptcy. It was what we had to do to keep him off the road and keep him healthy, Elizabeth McIntosh said. On top of the legal bills, the debt collectors, and the damage to a person's credit, for some, there's also a tremendous stigma toward bankruptcy. No one wants to go broke. It's very humiliating, said Robin Hallett, noting she was reluctant to even tell family members because of the shame. With millions out of work due to the pandemic, Hallett's situation will become more common, experts said. They expect the number of consumer bankruptcies to rise. Too many people are out of work to keep paying their bills. But how much bankruptcies will increase is still unknown and can vary widely depending on what aid Congress may supply. We're starting to see people who a year ago were nowhere near bankruptcy, particularly people who had small businesses or good jobs. We're seeing folks like that start to file, said Ed Boltz, a bankruptcy attorney in Durham. After a lull when the pandemic began, new calls to his office started up again in earnest in August when some of the consumer protections started to lapse. Cars are being repossessed again. Foreclosures are beginning to start again, Bolt said. About a third of workers furloughed when the pandemic hit were eventually laid off, according to one estimate. That's more medical bills that won't be paid, more doctor visits put off, and more nights of hunger. The bills will pile up, and with it the need to seek bankruptcy protection. It can feel like every step forward comes with two steps back, said Solomon, the sheriff's deputy. You think you've got a little something saved up over here, and then something comes up over here, and that takes over there, and then you start over. You start again, and you got a mess over here, Solomon said. It seems like it's always something all the time. Next, calamities challenge California's economic foundation. Businesses shuttered by the pandemic are slowly reopening, but technology complexes are quiet, their workers carrying on from home indefinitely. The smoke-filled skies had started to clear, but new fires have arrived in a fierce wildfire season that shows the intensifying efforts of climate change. Now California and its $3 trillion economy are confronting a profound question. How much will go back to normal and how much has been permanently changed? This is still the home of 40 million people, Hollywood, Silicon Valley, and the country's largest farming industry and port complex. In August, amid the pandemic, Apple became a $2 trillion company just 2 years after hitting $1 trillion. But the message from the recent calamities is clear. If California is to continue leading the nation's economy deep into the future, its leaders and residents will have to rethink where and how the state grows. For decades, California has operated under a trade-off. In exchange for high taxes and a high cost of living, its companies reap the rewards of an educated populace, an inviting lifestyle, and a culture of innovation. The events of 2020 have forced a closer look at the calculus. While the state is now recovering from the coronavirus, an assessment from the UCLA Anderson forecast predicts it will be at least 2 years before the economy has fully recovered. Mirroring the national economy, office vacancies are rising. Small businesses are teetering, and temporary layoffs are being made permanent. Superficially, the forecasts for California are no better or worse than the nation, with some sectors like tourism badly hurt, and others like technology barely touched. But between climate change and remote work, the state is facing questions that uniquely cut to the core of its economic identity. In the case of the pandemic, companies may increasingly ask whether the high cost of California cities is worth it if their workers can work remotely with the same productivity. Some companies may choose to leave the state altogether, and the spate of wildfires has brought new scrutiny to the spread-out development patterns that have accommodated an expanding population and pushed people to cheaper inland areas most exposed to fire. These have long been questions that have been in the back of people's minds, but now there's an actual drill, said Ted Egan, chief economist for the city of San Francisco. Companies have long moved sales and customer service jobs to cheaper cities like Phoenix, but they have been more reluctant to do so in areas like software engineering and management, figuring that proximity to the talent, research universities, and venture capital in the tech epicenter outweighed the higher cost of labor. Even before the pandemic, there were indications that that was starting to shift. Silicon Valley companies were increasingly putting jobs in engineering hubs in cities like Austin, Texas, and Toronto. Now they have an opportunity to run a remote working experiment on a scale that would not have otherwise been tried. Google and Facebook have said that they will allow employees to work remotely until 2021. Stripe, a payments company, recently announced that it would pay employees $20,000 to leave the San Francisco Bay Area if they accepted a salary reduction of up to 10% based on the cost of living where they went. Citing a shift toward more employees working from home, Pinterest, which allows people to save images to virtual pin boards, paid $90 million to cancel a lease for 500,000 square feet in an unbuilt office building in San Francisco. Nobody knows how efficient large-scale remote work will be over time, or if such arrangements will be attractive once people feel safe on public transportation and urban amenities like bars and restaurants have reopened. But if workers, untethered from their offices, flee the state, or companies start basing more high-paid workers elsewhere, it will have huge ramifications for California's outbreak. The past decade of economic expansion was heavily indebted to the boom in technology, and the state's budget, with its highly progressive tax structure, is unusually dependent on wealthier residents. Despite the diversity of California's vast economy, there is near universal agreement on one barrier to growth: the exorbitant cost of housing. The median price for single-family homes and condos in the state is closing in on $600,000, according to real estate site Zillow, more than twice the national level. The figure reflects a long-standing shortage that has also caused rising rents, crowded households, and two-hour commutes used to offset the cost of living. Much more than taxes, the reason that companies move jobs out of the state is lower-priced housing and the lower labor costs that go with it. Economists and planners have long counseled that the best way to relieve this pressure is to build more housing near the coastal job centers. But California has continued to sprawl, a pattern that has undermined the state's own emission reduction goals by encouraging longer commutes while placing more homes in fire zones. In 2010, the last year with available data, nearly a third of California housing was in the so-called wildland-urban interface, where wildfire risk is greatest, according to the U.S. Forest Service. Climate change is here. This is not some far-off theoretical thing, and we build houses over a multi-decade time frame in which they are going to be standing in these areas well into the time when the impact on the climate will be much more severe, said Kate Gordon, senior advisor to Governor Gavin Newsom on climate and director of the Governor's Office of Planning and Research. So there's no question we have to think differently about how we grow in the future. With a focus on compact development in previously built-out areas and not taking over undeveloped land, she said. This would seem like an easy enough mandate. After all, California has invested heavily in renewable energy. It was the first state to mandate solar power in new homes, and is run by a governor who has spoken of a climate dam emergency and recently signed an executive order banning sales of new gas-powered cars in 15 years. Yet there is ample indication that the politics of living with climate change are even more fraught than the politics of trying to prevent it. See, for instance, the debate over insurance rates in wildfire areas. California is trying to keep the rates low in fire-prone areas, something voters want, although many experts say states should let insurance rates rise in the long run to dissuade building in flood and fire-prone areas that are increasingly vulnerable. Or look at the state's long-running debate over housing. Going back to 2017, the legislature has begun each of the last few years with a flurry of bills intended to curb local zoning regulations and increase density by steering growth to existing areas. In other words, the same measures that climate experts say are crucial to tamping down wildfire risk. But despite a Democratic supermajority, the most ambitious bills have been undone by a strange bedfellows coalition of tenant advocates worried about gentrification and suburban voters fearing neighborhood change. When it comes to making the massive changes necessary to adapt to warming temperatures, it's really California against itself, and we're going to need to make some major reforms if we want to survive this, said Micah Weinberg, chief executive of California Forward, a nonprofit group pushing to shape the state's economic and government agenda. Next, two U.S. economists win Nobel for working on improving auctions. Two American economists won the Nobel Prize in Economics on Monday for improving how auctions work, research that underlies much of today's economy, from the way Google sells advertising to the way telecom companies acquire airwaves from the government. The discoveries of Paul R. Milgram and Robert B. Wilson, both of Stanford University, have benefited sellers, buyers, and taxpayers around the world, said the Nobel Committee. Wilson was once Milgram's Ph.D. advisor, and the two also happened to be neighbors in California, Milgram said. He received the news of the win in a strange way. I got a knock at my door from Bob Wilson when it was still the middle of the night, he said. Milgram, 72, said students, friends, and colleagues had long suggested he and Wilson, 83, might be due for the prize. It's nice to have their respect, but their affection as well, Milgram said. The two men tackled the tricky problem of making auctions work efficiently. The committee said Wilson's work showed why rational bidders tend to place bids below their own best estimate of the common value, which could mean the item goes for less than it's worth and perhaps not to the buyer who most wants it, neither of which is supposed to happen if the auction is working properly. The effects of their work can be seen all around. Online advertising is sold at auction, said David Warsh, who tracks economic research at his blog Economic Principles. We have run out of time for today's episode of Money Matters. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Pat Perry, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's episode of Money Matters is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Money Matters is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.